legal remedies to be pursued, and I suspect that there will be more developments on this in the near future. The courts are still open to hold officials to account when they exceed their constitutional authority, and I think that's what's going on here, and I suspect that we haven't seen the end of this.
Well, David Schultz, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic at Yale University. A happy belated birthday to Juan Gonzalez. Juan is in Delaware, where today has been there for 2 days giving speeches. You can check our website at democracynow.org. I'll be in Santa Fe, New Mexico tomorrow on October 17th at the Lenzic Theater, where the film Steal the Story, Please will be premiering in New Mexico. Be there at 6 o'clock and being involved with the Q&A after with the Oscar-nominated director, Tia Leson. On Saturday, I'll be at the Woodstock Film Festival in Woodstock, New York, at the Woodstock Playhouse at 3 o'clock. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
Remember these famous words from Gordon Gekko in The Wolf of Wall Street?
Well, in my book, you either do it right or you get eliminated. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Well, billionaires are in control today. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive in spite of all that.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Never has America had a presidential administration so unabashedly in the service of a chosen few special billionaire buddies. But these guys did the American Horatio Alger dream of lifting themselves up by their bootstraps and achieve the great wealth that unique freedom enables. Isn't it? Isn't that true? Maybe it's not. Why not have a government that serves the so-called job creators? After all, an economic trickle-down theory has always worked, has it not? Well, no, it never has. The reality is that it's trickle up. When more average citizens have more income, demand increases, and some of that money flows upward to the billionaire owners of production of the things we use every day. The picture of some of his favorite billionaires standing behind Trump at his second inauguration was a sign of things to come. His new America works for the benefit of billionaires, make no mistake about it. But at what actually tremendous price in terms of economic fairness and stability, to say nothing of the rush toward global climate disaster? Well, our returning guest to Keeping Democracy Alive comes from a unique position to talk about what he's going to talk about. It's been a very long time since Chuck Collins turned his back on the fortune that was coming to him from winning the wealthy family lottery. He is the great-grandson of Oscar F. Meyer, the founder of Oscar Meyer Meat Processing Brand, of course. Collins first gained public attention back in 1985 when he gave his inheritance to several foundations at age 26. When his father was afraid his son was a Marxist, though Collins instead stated that he would rather be called a Gandhian or a Christian. And indeed, that's what he is. Chuck Collins is back with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Great to be with you, Bert. Thanks for having me back.
Chuck Collins is an author and senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where he directs the Program on Inequality for the and the Common Good. He's also co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good. What a concept. An expert on economic inequality in the U.S., Collins has pioneered efforts to bring together investors and business leaders to speak out publicly against corporate practices and economic policies that increase economic inequality and destabilize us as a country. His latest book that we're going to talk about is Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. This in the age of Trump 2.0, when the president openly values billionaires above all other people. Kind of like feudalism, which is something that he no doubt has no understanding of. Well, a Dartmouth professor of sociology urges that this book be required reading for all our elected representatives. Of course, my sense is that members of Congress are not going to read this. It's just too much in the face of the current worship of all things billionaire. Burned by Billionaires has been called a scathing expose of the hidden impact of America's ultra-wealthy on our social, economic, political, and ecological landscape, as well as a path toward a more equitable future. As I say about this program, Keeping Democracy Alive, it's an exceptionally heavy lift. We need all hands on deck. In addition to his work with the International Policy Studies, Chuck Collins is author of over 10 nonfiction books about economic inequality, climate disruption, philanthropy, affordable housing, and the racial wealth divide, including The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions, Born on Third Base and with Bill Gates Sr., Wealth and Our Commonwealth, The Case for Taxing Inherited Fortunes. He lives in the beautiful countryside just south of Brattleboro, Vermont. I know where, but I'm not telling. Chuck, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Bert.
You've been working on the Program for Inequality and the Common Good at IPS for quite some time and have written a number of books on this topic. Why this book? Why now?
Well, I think a couple things. One is we're kind of moving into a new stage of inequality. I call it the kind of hyper-extractive stage, where this isn't just, you know, Bert Cohen or Bill Gates creating a better mousetrap or MS-DOS or something and, you know, creating a product and building a company and building wealth. This is when the billionaires have so much wealth and power that they're kind of rigging the rules to extract more wealth from the real economy. So that's one reason I wrote the book. The other is people, I still, you know, I co-edit a website, inequality.org, and people still kind of write to me. One guy wrote to me, he said, none of my problems exist as a result of someone else being a billionaire.
Nah.
And so I wrote back to Greg. I said, actually, Greg, well, maybe that barking dog across the street, that isn't caused by the billionaire, but most of your problems, most of the things that probably bother you, the cost of food, the cost of housing, the state of politics, the state of the environment, everything that touches your life, your health, your well-being, that is being disrupted and worsened by the concentration of wealth and power. And I like to say, we're being burned by the billionaires. Yes. Our lives are definitely being worsened by this economy that funnels wealth to the top, not across the bottom.
And across the bottom is where it needs to be, and people in business know that. When they build up demand, that's where the economy gets better. And many of us have heard of the Gilded Age. the late 1800s to the early 20th century. How does this today's Gilded Age compare to that one, do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels. You know, the first Gilded Age, 1880 to say 1910, the First World War, that was the great robber baron fortunes. That was the, you know, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the sort of rising fortunes after the Industrial Revolution or coming out of the Industrial Revolution. You know, 400 families owned and controlled, you know, who knows how much. We don't have the data look back, but, you know, half the wealth in the country. And they used their wealth and power to get more wealth and power. And a lot of people, Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court justice, said, you know, you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both. And it really gave rise to the progressive populist movement, the farmer rural movements, and right. even urban reformers. So, you know, so the similarities are similar. I mean, the similarities are enormous. Here we are, you know, 120 years later, in the second Gilded Age, where, you know, we have approaching 1,000 billionaires who have a huge percentage of the wealth and economy. So, you know, I think there's some similarities. I think that obviously the ability to capture the media and kind of the storytelling narrative apparatus of society's more complicated. You know, where people get their information, it maybe have been similar in the Gilded Age, the first Gilded Age, but, you know, I think we're up against some even more powerful forces in terms of manipulating the environment.
Yeah, and they're pretty open about it now. And one thing, you know, we toss around the word billion and billionaires, you know, just sort of nonchalantly. But do people really think about what a billion is? You know, it's 1,000 million. You might think somebody, yeah, people want to get rich, no doubt about it. It's fun to have stuff. But, you know, could somebody, I mean, can you not be satisfied with, say, 50 million or 100 million? Who needs 1,000 million? Never mind multi-thousands of millions. It's just, it's kind of a sickness, I think, that hopefully psychiatrists will figure out some way to deal with that. It's a sickness. It really is. We've all heard of the military-industrial complex made famous by President Eisenhower, one of our good liberal presidents. You say that there's something called the wealth defense industry these days. Huh? What is that? What are its components? And is Trump's big, beautiful bill part of that wealth defense industry? And if so, in what way? What is that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's the first phase of people becoming wealthy, which usually is connected to a company or a product. But shortly after that, and particularly when people hit that $40, $50 million wealth level, they start to use their wealth to defend their wealth. They fend off competition. They hire tax attorneys and accountants and wealth managers to hide their money and minimize their tax. And so that is the wealth defense industry. There literally is a class of professional enablers, if you will, who see their role as helping the rich get richer and protect their pile. You know, I think there are individual pathological behaviors among the billionaire class. But what I try to do to say in this book is this isn't about individual behavior. It's now a system that's almost sort of on autopilot, meaning if we don't intervene, a generation from now, the sons and daughters of today's billionaires are going to be dominating our politics, culture, economy, philanthropy. Oof. I mean, you might be thinking we're there already. But actually, Elon Musk's little kids haven't even grown up yet. I mean, Larry Ellison, the second richest man in the world, his son is you know, controls a huge media conglomerate. So we're going to have more of that sort of hereditary dynastic power. You mentioned feudalism in your introduction. It essentially is something that people in the U.S., we don't necessarily understand. Right. Maybe if you lived under sharecropping, you did. But, you know, we are moving back toward a feudalistic system where these huge wealthy barons pretty much rule. and the rest of us are subjects. That's and I don't think anybody really wants to go there. I don't think all the billionaires really want to go there. I think it's just that's what happens when the economy is rigged so much to funnel wealth to the hands of a few.
Wow. Yeah, people don't think about that. I mean, I seriously doubt that Trump has ever even heard the word feudalism, never mind understand it. There are tax havens around the world. How do they work? And about how much money is sequestered away and kept these super wealthy people from paying their fair share of taxes?
Well, part of it is we really don't know because right. It is secret. There are some really good estimates, some scholars, and there's also been a lot of leaks, data leaks from inside the wealth advisor world. But just to be clear, what happens when you really hit that high level of wealth is you hire your wealth defense professionals to move your money around, to create trusts, to move some of that money offshore, you know, the Grand Cayman Islands or the British mm-hmm. Virgin Islands are well known for parking trusts and having anonymous bank accounts. But here's the thing. The billionaires don't have to do that anymore. The United States has become a tax haven. Certain states have rewritten their laws to attract, you know, capital like South Dakota. You know, they basically said, oh, well, we want to help the trust industry. And so wealthy people can create an anonymous shell company in Delaware and create a trust in South Dakota. And now we have billionaires from around the world bringing their wealth to the U.S. because it's a tax haven and they can hide their money here. That actually has a negative effect, particularly on our housing market, because these billionaires are buying up, you know, real estate in communities all across the country. Anyway, the U.S. has become a tax haven, and certain states have become tax haven enabling states: Delaware, South Dakota, Nevada, Florida, Texas, Wyoming. Those are the states that the billionaires are taking their money to park it and hide it.
They are. Well, I'm not moving there. I won't even visit. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our returning guest is an old friend. We've been knowing each other for a very long time. Chuck Collins, who is a senior scholar and author of many books, a senior scholar with Institute for Policy Studies, directs the program on equality, inequality, and the common good. We're talking about his latest book, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Our Planet. And one thing Trump is not shy about, many things, one of them is he's not shy about shifting more services from the federal government to the states. That's an old call, states' rights, stuff like that. How unique is that? And how significant is that? And how might that affect by how we are burned by billionaires?
You know, it's really part of a multi-decade trend that has happened both under Republicans and unfortunately under some Democrats,
right,
which is to shift taxes and responsibilities off the federal government onto states and localities. And here we are, and this is a really important point, I think, for a lot of us when we just talk to our neighbors. People complain about their local property taxes. God, my property tax bill went up, and darn that town and the select board or the mayor or the city government. What we don't realize is there's been this kind of invisible slow motion shift off of corporate tax onto individual tax, off federal onto state and local, which tend to be more regressive, meaning low income people pay a higher percentage of their income in right. property taxes, off of wealth and taxing capital gains and onto income. And if you do that for 30, 40 years, you end up where, oh, our local property taxes are picking up more of the cost of education, more of the cost of infrastructure. And people are resentful and mad, and understandably so.
Sure.
But what we don't think is, darn billionaires, they're the ones who've engineered this tax shift. They're the ones who've lobbied to continually cut taxes on the rich and shift them onto everyone else. So the tax, you know, each of us are picking up the slack for the billionaires who are opting out of paying taxes.
So we never blame billionaires where they actually deserve some blame.
That's right. No, that's true. We, you know, and I think hopefully when people read my book, they'll be like, they'll sort of like, it'll be like the Matrix. Your eyes open up and you see like, wow, look at the billionaires are, they're coming for my pets. You know, they're trying to squeeze more money out of veterinary care. They're coming for my health care. They're coming for my housing. You know, like all those problems, all those big expense items, our grocery bill, is because these billionaires have found a way to extract more money from the things that we need.
And one thing that we need and is becoming increasingly more obvious is housing, affordable housing. Back in the 50s, there was something called redlining, where real estate interests would get together and decide, you know, draw a literal sometimes red line at over which black people were not allowed to cross. It kept wealth through housing in the hands of white people. That's, I don't think that's happening as much now. But what about housing? And there's a tremendous need for more affordable housing, huge and growing very quickly and rather frighteningly so. How does burn by billionaires affect the housing situation?
It's in a sense that this imbalance of wealth is supercharging the housing problem. Mm. We've always had sort of that basic dynamic of gentrification, where wealthy people bid up the cost of housing, or second home buyers bid up the cost of housing in a community. But we're now seeing this hyper problem, and you know, in a way, the billionaires are, if you go to any major city, the billionaires are buying up luxury housing. There's new luxury housing being built. They're displacing the millionaires, who are then displacing everybody else. Yeah. And a sector of the billionaires are saying, hey, how can we make money off this? You know, let's buy up the mobile home park. As one of the investors said, you know, owning a mobile home park as an investor is like owning a Waffle House, where the customers are chained to the seats. They can't go anywhere. They're just forced to pay their higher rents. Buying up single family houses in some markets. There are whole neighborhoods in Minneapolis I've walked around where, you know, half the single family houses on the block are owned by an investor billionaire who knows that people can't, in today's market, they can't afford to buy a house for various right. reasons. Even though they're middle class and have decent incomes, they can't afford to buy. So they're going to be stuck, backed up in the rental market, and we can keep charging them rent. They'll never build equity. They'll just keep paying me rent, and right. we can make money doing that. So you see these big private billionaire-backed private equity funds buying up single-family houses, apartment buildings, converting apartment buildings to short-term rentals, taking the property off the market as a home for somebody and having it be a vacation rental. And then, as I mentioned earlier, those billionaires coming in from around the world, where do they invest their money? Well, they want to spread it around, and real estate is a good way to diversify your wealth holdings. So they're buying up U.S. real estate. So now we have global billionaires driving up the cost of housing. So all those things together are making it harder for people to be housed, for people to pay affordable rents, or meet the dream, America dream, of maybe someday owning their own home. All that is worsened by billionaires in the housing market.
And dear listener, you thought billionaires weren't affecting your lives. Ha! Stay with us. There's more to come. Wait, there's more. With an issue like climate change, we're obviously all in it together. And here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, every now and then there are these unbelievable super yachts that come in to dock here. I can't imagine how much they pay per day, but it doesn't matter. Money is obviously no object. And the pollution from these super lots for super yachts is obviously no problem. But for us to survive, you write, the rich will have to change their behavior to a much greater degree than the rest of us. In what ways? And do you see any indication that they are willing to change their behavior and that they may do it? What would they have to do? But everybody has to change their behavior somewhat, you know, reuse, recycle, try to avoid creating so much trash. But what especially would the billionaires have to change about their behavior to a much greater degree than the rest of us?
Well, the billionaires, or, you know, really the top 0.1%.
Right.
You know, I say billionaire, but I'm really talking about that 0.1%. They are the super emitters. They're the biggest polluters. They have more houses, more big cavernous houses that need to be heated. They fly on private jets as opposed to commercial, which is 20 to 30 times more polluting than a commercial flyer. Mm. And these super yachts are the most polluting form of transportation, both in terms of their emissions and their offloading of pollutants. So, you know, and so that's why their behavior, for the Earth to heal and survive, they're going to have to fly their private jets less. They're going to have fewer private jets. They're going to have fewer houses that are 10,000 square feet. All of that is just part of the problem. But you say changing behavior. I think, you know, all of us, particularly those of us who live in the global north, have some responsibility to reduce our own individual carbon footprint.
Yes.
But we feel like chumps when we, you know, like, oh, should I walk or take the bike today, or, you know, not fly as much? You know, those are the things that most people are grappling with. And then, you know, Kylie Jenner's like flying their jet for, you know, across LA for lunch. And the billionaires are, you know, they like to make you think they're using their private jet for business, but at least half those flights are recreation in nature. Huge emissions. So, you know, the rest of us feel like chumps for trying to, you know, and it undermines the sense of shared sacrifice and solidarity we're going to need to face the disrupted future that's coming our way. So, you know, whether it's increasing wildfires and smoke getting in our eyes, or droughts like we're living through here, or flooding, disrupted weather events, all of that's our future. How are we going to grapple with that? How are we going to change our lives? And that's where, look, we need the billionaires to step up and change their lives the most, alter their behavior the most.
Do you see any indication that they're listening to that, and that they may be changing their behavior?
Well, you know, there's a segment of billionaires who totally have gotten this and have been very public.
And maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're like Tom Steyer, or Bill Gates has been pretty outspoken on climate change. Michael Bloomberg, you know, funded the social movements to try to cut down coal. But here's the thing, under Trump, we've gone in a very short time from moving along, you know, insufficiently, but nevertheless moving toward reducing emissions, changing energy policy. Now we're shutting down wind plants and keeping coal plants open, all at the behest of the fossil fuel billionaires. And that's the other thing. There's a segment of the billionaires, I call them the fossil fuel billionaires, and they've kind of teamed up with, you know, the tech AI types too, who are really excited about their energy sucking data centers. Anyway, they have used their wealth and power and position to block a transition to a healthier green economy.
Absolutely amazing.
And they're using their power and flexing their muscles to keep us on this trajectory, you know, that's unsustainable. So we not only need to get billionaires to change their lifestyle, we also got to get them to stop funding and investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure and lobbying to keep the bad practices in place. And they're reaping a windfall right now from Trump, because, you know, the coal barons are dancing in the streets. I mean, they've got Trump to declare an energy emergency, kind of a phony energy emergency, just like we're having phony, you know, urban crime situations. And that's given them the authority to keep coal plants that were scheduled for closure, to keep them open. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And what about the power of the billionaires in Washington? Let's face it, the lobbyists in Washington, I mean, I don't think there's anything that compares to AIPAC, but there's some powerful lobbies in Washington. What effect do they have, the billionaire lobbyists, as compared to lobbyists of say, average people. I mean, we're not without power. There are people's lobbies in Washington. What about how that's working? Are they are they members of Congress starting to get that people are not real pleased with the effect that the multi-billionaires are having on the planet and having on things like housing, et cetera?
You know, clearly some of them are. But I think, and again, we've seen kind of a steady billionaire capture of our political system.
Yeah.
It's not a completely locked down, but it's getting there. Each of our listeners should be upset about how these folks are essentially robbing us of our voice and our vote, diminishing our impact. Voting still matters, but less and less.
Yeah.
Because the billionaires basically decide who gets to run for office and then what the policies are, and they use their clout to block very popular changes. So the billionaires, you know, are the standing in the way of our having an accountable democracy. I think the way it's going to change is that we're going to start to see people run for office and win based on a program of, hey, I'm going to help everybody, not the billionaires,
uh-huh.
or not just the billionaires. I'm going to work for an economy that lifts up everybody, not preferences billionaires. And they're going to start winning political office. And that's going to change the dynamics, because right now you got a Republican Party that's completely lockstep, 100% own subsidiary of the extractive billionaire class. We've got the Democrats who half of them are in cahoots,
at least,
you know, because they're you know, so then it's carving out. It may be a new political formation or a populist wing of either of those parties really stepping up and saying, we want our elected officials to help us, not the billionaires, and not this phony populism too, not the
right,
oh yeah, I'm going to help you while I give my rich friends tax breaks. That's, you know, at some point the sleeping giant of American apathy is going to wake up to that, and hopefully sooner rather than later.
I certainly hope so. And I am one who believes that the Democratic Party is lost in the wilderness right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there for the taking at the local level. If people stop complaining about, complain, sure, but then act on taking over your local Democratic Party. Bring it to the populist left, dare I say. It's been there in the past. I mean, we've had the prairie populists in the past. We're in the Midwest. It's not out of the question. Anyway, I don't want to veer too off. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s. Yes, I'm that old. When, believe it or not, there was a wide and strong middle class. Really, there was. For three decades after the Second World War, between 47 and 77, the overall income and wealth inequality in the U.S. declined. What was going on during that time that moved us toward greater economic equality? And then what happened in the late 70s to change that picture?
You know, I think this is a really important point you're raising, Bert, which is after World War II, 1945 to the mid-70s, we had an economy that actually wasn't subservient to the rich. Was it focused on expanding the middle class?
Yes.
We taxed the rich. I'll give you my my imitation of the senior senator for Vermont. He said, under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, but the richest 1% paid over, you know, significantly, you know, 90% of their income over a certain level.
Yes.
And it was invested in debt-free college and infrastructure and access to housing and home ownership for the middle class and for working class people. You know, so we know how to do that. We know taxing the rich, not just to raise revenue, but to diminish their power in a democratic society. To save democracy, we need to tax the rich. But then you can also raise revenue to make investments that help non-wealthy people have an opportunity and a good life. And, you know, the American dream, as I write in my book, moved to Canada. The American dream of social mobility lives in Northern Europe. That's where you don't have to be born into a wealthy family to have decent opportunities.
Right.
You can go to college without debt. You can get job training. You can get access to healthcare and not be wiped out. And you don't have to worry about your parents growing old because there's support for aging and growing old. Everyone in the U.S. is stressed out because we have to do this, take care of kids, take care of parents, all individualized solutions. It doesn't have to be this way. We can create a thriving, we are a wealthy, smart, educated society. We can create much better opportunities for everybody. And it doesn't mean the rich are going to go without, you know? Again, I'm talking about people with $40 million or more. You know, they have all their needs taken care of and their desires. Their kids are going to be fine. Their grandkids are going to be fine. The problem is when they stop buying mansions and jets and start buying senators and media. And that's where we have to step in and say, sorry, that's too much wealth and power for a healthy society. It's not that we hate rich people. It's not an individual personality thing, although some of the personalities are annoying. It's a system that keeps funneling wealth to the top, and that's the problem.
It is indeed. And multi-billion, well, let me, for a definition of terms, 0.01%. What is that? What does that mean in terms of actual dollars? The billionaires that we're talking about are 0.01% of the economy. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, it's actually, and in my book, I do what I call the roadmap to Richistan. So there's Billionaireville. There's Billionaireville, you know, 902 billionaires in the U.S. with 7.8 trillion. Okay, that's one group. But the next tier down, what we call upper Richistan, people in that top 0.1%. So now you've got $40 to $50 million and up to the billionaire class. And that's, you know, like 130,000 households. So it's not a small group, but it's not a tiny group. And that's where the power resides. That's where you're using your influence and clout to defend your wealth and block legislation you don't like. All of that is key. So, and that's where we should focus on, you know, taxing the rich. When I say taxing the rich, really focus on the 40 million and up group.
So that would be the 0.01%, 40 million assets and up.
Yeah, the top 0.1%. And they're the big winners of the last 15 years. Most of the gains of income and wealth have gone to that 0.1%, which is not to say that the top 1% or the top 10% are hurting. They're kind of benefiting, but they're not the drivers of the policy change that we're living through.
Oh, interesting. So instead of having a country where, say, 99% of the people are served by their government, 0.01% of the people are specifically served by the government. What a great picture. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, the show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and we actually chose this title well before Trump got elected. It's a heavy lift. Our guest today is Chuck Collins, who's got a brand new book out, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. And multi-billionaire, you talk about earth problems. Multi-billionaires like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, and others have so much money they dream of leaving the pull of the gravity we mere humans are burdened with. What does that tell us?
Yeah, it tells us that they have this kind of delusional fantasy that somehow there's a planet B that we can trash this planet and then that they are going to, you know, create a space colony on Mars or something. You got to worry about this kind of perspective. First of all, let's look around. We've been given heaven on Earth here. We have this beautiful green water orb floating in space. Our job is to be protectors and stewards of it, not trash it and try to find a new home. It's concerning that the billionaires think they can not only opt out of society and taxes, but opt out of our planet. I actually write about one of my favorite sci-fi movies. I don't know if you ever saw Elysium.
No, I never saw it.
With Matt Damon and Jodie Foster. But it's basically about a century into the future from now, the rich have withdrawn to a satellite named Elysium, where they live in luxury. They don't even get sick. They have this thing that looks like an MRI machine called a med bay, and they just climb into it, and it's like, oh, you have a tumor. Here, we'll take care of that. You know. Meanwhile, down on Earth, the rest of humanity is living in the brutal, polluted, toxic, overpopulated Earth, this degraded little planet, working like drones and being supervised by robots. And anyway, it's a worthwhile movie to watch in a sense to say, this is not where we want to go, but this is if we don't do anything, if we just stay on inequality autopilot, this is where we're heading. We're heading into this Elysium future. So check it out so you know what we don't want and where we don't want to go and why we urgently need to change course.
And I can't help but think, Chuck, that you have also seen the movie Don't Look Up. Interesting similarities here in terms of the wealthy people leaving the Earth behind. As regular listeners know, I'm a rabid student of history. In various times of revolution in history, such as Europe in the big revolutions, they're Europe-wide revolutions of 1848, the most steadfast defenders of the ruling class, oddly enough, were the peasants. In recent decades, one has seen some of the most ardent support for the wealthy class coming from the people who live, say, in trailer parks and the like. Many lower-income people seem to defend the rich with the belief that those who make a lot of money deserve it and that they themselves may be rich someday. What do you say to this historical reality?
Well, I think that there are these powerful narratives and stories that justify inequality. Like, you know, everyone deserves to be where they are.
Right,
know?
Right.
J. Paul Getty was once asked, how do you become wealthy in America? He said, it's actually pretty easy. You got to get up early every morning. You probably got up early this morning, right, Bert?
I did.
You
know? Yes.
Work hard all day. Find oil. Those were his. But when people see, you know, a billionaire, they say, oh, they got up early. They worked hard. They worked smart. You know, they took risks. There's a sort of story that justifies that wealth. As opposed to, like, you know, at a certain stage, those folks are blocking the competition, taking taxpayer subsidies and putting them in their pocket, benefiting from the fertile ground that we all create together, but growing private wealth. So, you know, it is important to tackle. And I think I think that, like, oh, I can be rich too someday. That's sort of weakening. You know, I know if I've been watching the polling on this, people's attitudes about inequality are shifting.
Yeah.
We used to have a very high tolerance for inequality in our society. If we feel like the rules are fair and everyone can have access to it, well, more and more people are understanding the rules are rigged and that the billionaires are pulling up the opportunity ladder, and particularly younger people, people in their 20s and 30s, they have a very different view about these inequalities and about billionaires. It's the older people who are still like, oh, they're so awesome. I hope I can be one someday.
Right.
And actually, they don't see that they're getting their pocket picked. So, you know, that's hopeful in a sense that people are, you know, seeing that these inequalities are not an accident. They're not weather events. They're not tied to some great virtue that these individuals have.
Right.
It's a function of a system of tax policies and rules that is funneling wealth to the top to the detriment of everyone else. And we know how to rewire the economy. We know how to have things go the other way. Broader shared prosperity, not private wealth.
Shared prosperity. Oil. There's oil. You know, people forget about that. There's a lot of degrees of luck involved in people's economic status. I mean, as J. Paul Getty said, get up early, work hard, find oil. A lot of people blame themselves if they're not wealthy, but the reality is there is a lot of luck involved. And why can't there be more equality of opportunity in terms of housing and health and issues like that? Republicans have long called the super rich job creators. It's a word that's obviously poll tested and it's gotten a lot of ground. Is that not accurate? Are the super rich not job creators?
Well, here's what's important. I really try to break this down in our book. There's a stage where somebody does start a company in a business, and they do create jobs, you know, in an environment where there's, you know, and I, you know, we're in the town I live in, there's this guy, Tito, who basically makes a great burrito. He started off, you know, selling his burritos on the street corner, and now then he had a food truck, and now he has a restaurant. Now he has four restaurants. He's you know, become stable and prosperous, not super rich. That's sort of the narrative we love to focus on.
Yes. This,
you know, but what we don't realize is now we're at the stage of, I call it the hyper extractive stage. These are not job creators. These private equity firms are coming in and buying up functioning, profitable businesses, squeezing them harder, laying people off. Hospitals are closing.
Yes.
Not because they're unprofitable, but because they're not earning 25% returns for their investors. So there's a big difference between the virtuous job creator stage of capitalism or individuals who are out there. And I know running a business is not easy and people should be rewarded for the headaches that they go through. But that's different than the billionaire wealth extractors who are squeezing the economy for more nickels, squeezing each of us, picking our pockets, you know, charging rents. You know, okay, I'm a dog walker and I'm making some money walking dogs. And then I join Rover.com and I pay $50 to put my dog walking services up there. And the customers simply use an app and they find me and hire me and they take Rover.com takes a cut from both of us. They're not creating any value. They're not walking anybody's dog. They're just using this platform, social networking platform, and they're skimming rents off of it. Are they wealth creators? Are they job creators? Not really. They're just skimming off the productive economy. You can see that all over now, whether it's Uber or, you know, Airbnb or all these other sort of app-based networking. They like set up a toll booth between different parts of the productive economy.
Mm.
So that's not job creating. That's rent extraction.
One thing it's difficult is communication. You know, the Republicans have been very successful at communicating job creators. That's easy to understand, easy to get. A few short, simple words. I mean, let's face it, Trump is a master at that stuff. I mean, he makes stuff up and just puts it out there again and again and again. And people on the left, dare I say, have a harder time doing that. But you're saying that people are starting to get that there is this serious wealth inequality and that job creation is not so much happening as it's squeezing the every penny they can get out of their workers. I wonder how much progress we can make on this communicating the reality of it.
Well, part of it is to celebrate small business owners and entrepreneurs who are creating businesses and jobs.
Uh-huh.
You know, that there are a segment of those folks. They're not becoming ultra rich unless they, you know, unless Tito sells out to Chipotle, he's not going to be that rich.
Uh-huh.
But you know, so I think the left or progressives or whatever need to sort of honor, yeah, there's a segment of business owners in our community who are working hard and are adding huge value to our community and should be celebrated and should be reasonably rewarded. But should they be paid, you know, 1,000 times their workers? I don't think so. Should they be paid, you know, 1,000,000 times their workers? I don't think so. You know, like that's where it becomes extreme inequality.
Yeah.
So there might be some, you know, small, modest levels of inequality. You know, Bert, you get up earlier than me and you work harder than me. Maybe you should be paid 25% more than me, but not 1,000 times more than me.
Right.
And I think we have to find that way to talk about, yeah, we celebrate the job creators. What we don't like are the hyper wealth extractors, the job looters. That's what we're up against here.
Job looters. I don't know the numbers, but I think the ratio of in a company, the lowest paid worker versus the highest paid worker in the 50s and 60s was one thing, and it's quite a bit different now. I bet you have those numbers off the top of your head.
Yeah, I mean, even in the early 80s, the gap between the highest paid CEOs and workers in a company was kind of like 20 to 1, 25 to 1. Then it's just steadily grown apart. I mean, it's like at one point it was like 400 to 1. Institute for Policy Studies, we just did a report looking at very specific sector of industries. 600 to 1 gap between average worker and the CEOs and the bosses. That divide just keeps growing, and it is part of the problem. But those are the CEOs managing the companies, and sometimes they're not the owners who are the biggest behind the scenes wealth extractors.
Interesting. I mentioned how your father was concerned that you might be a Marxist, but you consider yourself a Gandhian or Christian. So, I mean, the right wing that's currently in power talks about, you know, socialism and the dangers of socialism in Portland, Oregon, and soon to be, hopefully, New York City. You're not a Marxist?
No, you know, I don't think those labels really mean much anymore. I mean, I do like the, here's what I would say is, if you care about capitalism, you should be freaking out and alarmed about this kind of weird crony favoritism capitalism that's under the Trump era. If you really care about support for businesses and free markets, you should be alarmed at this sort of destruction of investment in science and infrastructure and in the commons, really,
yeah, really.
That enables commerce and wealth to happen. So I would be happy with a kind of a democratic capitalism or social capitalism where, you know, there's free markets and private enterprise operating in a society where there's rules and guardrails and fair taxes and a social safety net.
That's the country I grew up in, I thought.
Yeah, that exactly. When people say make America great again, I mean, I think, you know, you mean the back when you could graduate from high school and get a decent paying job and buy a house and your kids didn't have to, go for want and you could retire before you died, you know, like that's the American dream. Now it's in Canada or Northern Europe. There's more entrepreneurship in the Scandinavian countries. You know, again, the right often denigrates, oh, those are welfare states. Those are pro-work states. They want you to get off, you know, if you've lost your job, they want to retrain you so you can get back in the workforce and pay taxes. And their rates of entrepreneurship are much higher than the U.S.
Oh, interesting.
Social mobility is pretty much stalled out in the U.S., and social mobility in Canada is much greater. If you're not born rich, you can have greater opportunities than if you're not born rich in the United States.
Well, hopefully some of this anger can be focused on making a change. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. You tuned in late, but we got some more to discuss. Our guest today is Chuck Collins, who's got a new book out, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Our Planet. I like to use the phrase economic democracy myself, but there's all kinds of good phrases. As we get more money, people like to get more money. They like to buy more stuff and have, you know, a nicer life. And as the great George Carlin pointed out, when we buy more stuff, we need bigger homes to put all that stuff in. Then we get more stuff, we need a bigger home. So you get more stuff. Anyway, it's not just billionaires affecting climate change. Is this not part of human nature? Is there some extreme line that gets crossed by billionaires when it comes to getting more stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that it's part of going back to the billionaires as the super consumers, super emitters. You know, on the one hand, you could say, well, yeah, that's the market and they're driving consumption and they're buying more wheat stuff. And so there's jobs that are created by that. But they're not the best jobs and they're not the most environmentally useful to just keep, you know, making giant piles of stuff that then end up in landfills.
Right.
We're better off with a more broadly distributed wealth where people can, you know, meet basic needs. I mean, again, in Europe, you have really efficient appliances, you have efficient cars, you have a kind of more modest standard of living, but it's more broadly shared. Here you have these extremes of deprivation and dynasty, if you will.
Yeah, really.
So that, you know,
Mainstream Democrats do not dare to take on the idea of taxing the wealthy more, a wealth tax. But when I spoke with an on-the-ground reporter in rural Wisconsin, the heartland of America, she told me how popular a wealth tax would be with the heartland. The National Democratic Party obviously is lost in the wilderness today. Briefly, there was one shining moment when Kamala Harris came out of the convention calling for a wealth tax, but then she never mentioned it again. Your thoughts on how to boost the political fortunes of the Democrats in middle America? Does it have to do with the wealth tax, do you think?
Well, I think being really clear that we should tax high levels of wealth and not, you know, Jane and Joe wealth, which is their modest savings. But again, wealth starting at $40 million. We have an inheritance tax, what's called an estate tax in the U.S.
Right.
It starts now on households with wealth like over $28 million, meaning your first $28 million will not be subject to this tax. Now, they don't want you to know that. They want to think everybody's and their brother's going to have to pay the death tax, the estate tax, whatever. Right. But in fact, it's almost optional now. It's a joke. The billionaires have found workarounds and opted out, and they're not paying this inheritance tax. But we should tax inheritances. That's how you prevent feudalism and dynastic wealth from building up. And, you know, it's so, you know, I think the good news is, 3 years ago, Congress came within two votes of passing Build Back Better, not the big ugly bill, but Build Back Better, a $4.2 trillion investment bill over 10 years, modernized our child care system, built tremendous investments in infrastructure and energy transition away from fossil fuels, addressed health care and broadened health access for children, raised millions of people out of poverty. I mean, this was the Democratic program, all paid for by tax increases on the super rich, some reductions in military spending. We came within two votes of that, two votes. So that's in our memory. So in some ways, the Democrats coming back with that same program, but really doing a better job talking about how this is going to make a difference for working class people around the country and really putting that program out there.
Well, I'm somewhat optimistic, more than somewhat optimistic about, I think it's Gen Z. I'm not sure exactly the definitions, the cutoffs of what Gen Z is, but there's soon to be yet another No King's Day. My daughter is about to turn 29, and she's part of Gen Z. They are very psyched. Here in New England, I could say wicked psyched about making these changes that we're talking about. How hopeful do you feel about recognizing that we are being, as your book says, burned by billionaires, how concentrated wealth and power are ruining our lives and planet? What do you think about this new generation? I mean, my parents were hopeful about my generation, the old hippie generation. I'm hopeful about this generation. Your thoughts, Chuck?
Well, I also have a 29-year-old daughter, just like you.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm very encouraged. I do think that there are some huge cracks in this billionaire system. More and more people are waking up to the harms of everyday life. They understand the billionaires have captured our political system. They understand that the concentration of wealth is pulling up the ladder and blocking their avenue to opportunity and a decent life. They know how hard it is to economically become adults with rising housing costs and the cost of cars and car insurance and groceries and, you know, every step of the way, they're ability to become economically independent is much harder, and they know this has to do with the current political thing. So I think that that is really promising, and I think overall the sort of sleeping giant of American apathy and inattention or despair. The reality is a lot of people feel like they don't have agency, they don't have ability to make this better. They're better off trying to find their individual solution to a big system problem. But there are limits to that, you know, when the system is tipped and rigged a certain way. So, but I think that here's the thing. I think Trump isn't going to address the underlying grievances that got him elected, the underlying pain, you know, declining wages
rising costs.
Yeah, phony populism isn't going to deliver. And so people are going to wake up in a year or in 3 years and say, okay, you know, and the pendulum may swing again. And then it's the question of will those, the moribund Democrats who have been also captured by a segment of the party has been captured by the billionaires.
Yes.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't talk about taxing the rich. Don't do that.
Right.
Well, guess what? That is a taxing the rich is incredibly popular.
Yes.
Among 70% of the voters, including Republicans. They know the rich aren't paying their fair share and they're laughing all the way to the bank. And that came out of the pandemic when people saw, whoa, the billionaires, the wealth of U.S. billionaires doubled during the 2-year pandemic and everyone else is more precarious. What's wrong with this picture? You know, I think attitudes about taxation, if the Democrats got ahead of the parade of where most people are at, they would be able to move on this program. But they can't let the elites in the Democratic Party define the debate.
Well, that's fearsome, I think, for a lot of Democrats, because the elites have the campaign dollars, and they don't want to alienate them, I suppose. But it's about the money for campaigns is to win votes. And if votes are there to tax, you know, favoring taxing the wealthy, that's where the votes are. It may take the Democrats a while to get that, but hopefully they'll get that. The book is called Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet, and the publisher is, I don't recall.